Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
Barrett to Farrell. Here comes Alex Good again. Meant for Ashton. Oh, this might be absolutely perfect. It is. Coming through for Vunipola that time, but Wigglesworth and Good has picked the good line. And he's almost there. And Wigglesworth has it back, and here comes Cruz. They can play all styles, all forms. And we're seeing here why they are champions. Parrott into Ruggeri. Ruggeri nearly there. Needs a bit of help. He got it. Clemon have got it. Up comes Lopez. And then it's Lee. Yarto has got a bend in and outside. He's previously scored in a final. He's going to score again. Clemon have earned. And Nick of Bendenen. It's back with Farrell. And here's Alex Gordon. And there's the try. Saracens still champions of Europe, and they join that elite club of clubs who have retained European rugby's number one club prize.
There you are. That was Saracens 28, Clermont 17 at Murrayfield on Saturday. So they are two-time European champions back to back, and they're on for doing the double-double. They have a semi-final against Exeter, separating them from a place, a fourth consecutive Premiership final appearance. So they could do the double-double, which has never been done before in English rugby. Gavin Comiskey, the Irish Times, is here, and we'll get on to the line stuff as well, which emerged today. And Eddie O'Sullivan is on the line. You're both very welcome. Eddie, just how good is this Saracens team? Where does it rank in the history of Heineken Cup, Champions Cup teams, winners that we've seen?
Well, I think they're right up there, because you put back-to-back European championships together, you know, you're going to be a serious outfit. I think as well, the manner in which they play the game, it's actually not that exciting. They play percentage rugby, rarely run their own half, you know, kick for position. But their defence is so good as well, it's very hard to break them down. As we saw at Munster, not able to break them down. They just are a very good product. I mean, they've built this team fairly painstakingly over the years, and it's really come to fruition now in terms of their academy, their whole atmosphere around the club. And Martin McCall is in situ there for so many years now. It just runs like a well-oiled machine. So they're right up there. And, you know, they wouldn't back against them, you know, coming back again next year, you know, and doing it again. They're the team in Europe to beat.
Gav, Clermont did get this back to a point late on. They scored an amazing try, and Owen Farrell was putting his backside on the left-hand touchline as well. And still, you never actually felt the Saracens were going to lose this game at all.
Especially not the Clermont, who just did it again, didn't they? Yeah. They got themselves into contention to win a major European game. And you can't actually just say they blew it. They did a little bit, but the Saracens team were awesome. Just switching it to from an Irish perspective, John O'Gibbs couldn't solve the Claremont problem, and now he's got a huge problem with Ulster from July now, from pre-season there. So I don't know. I'm sure he can bring some lessons to Belfast from Claremont's losing mentality, I suppose. But Saracens are.
I think Claremont, though, you know, their flaws are very simple. One is they don't have really an attacking game plan. It's very French. They play off the cuff so much. You get the odd starter play at that, and. But Parra runs the game, and it's very much off the cuff stuff. And they've got phenomenal athletes, and that's what kept them in the game. And
they're the Saracens, though, so they couldn't run over them. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it kept them in the game. But they did, and their passion, they play on passion. But the bigger problem is their defence is catastrophic. I mean, look, Leinster should have been in that final. Had Leinster not gifted them a 15-point lead, Leinster tore them to shreds in the second half. And it was the same problems last weekend. With Saracens like Clermont biting down on dummy runners that were never getting the ball, and the ball goes out the back and they're skinned on the outside, and Saracens butchered a few great opportunities, you know, to finish off Clermont, kind of catch them in the game. I'd say Martin McCall at points was worried that maybe, you know, they'd given these guys a lifeline. So they're an incredible squad, but they don't put it together in terms of a structured attack that get some against good teams to dismantle a good defence, and defensively they're very vulnerable, and I always felt whatever about them playing a better attacking, I always felt Saracens would pick them apart, as they did more than once, but it took until the very end to put them away. So you know, their defence is a disaster at that level. That's the one thing that keeps jumping out at me, and I think Leinster would kick themselves forever for not being in that final on the weekend.
Eddie mentioned there how Saracens have turned around the culture at the club, and it was a club traditionally where there was a revolving door, lots of players in, lots of players out, big turnover of squad and management, and they were never going to be a team where it was the players from the catchment area who were going to be the backbone. But Brendan Venter put things like a creche in place and tried to build a family atmosphere, and Mark McCall's talked about doing the same thing. So that's all very admirable. They are, though, it seems, the most indebted club in English rugby, to the tune of between 45 and 50 million pounds sterling from what you can see from reports. And I don't know, like, Gav, you've looked into this, so I don't know where you got with your investigation into it. It seems in the summer of 2015, from reports, they would have paid close to 10 million in salaries. And the salary cap for 2016-17 season is 6.5 million. It's 7 million for next year. So it seems like they're routinely going over that. I know Premiership Rugby have looked at it, and the official line was they were unable to prove that Saracens had breached previous limits. So I don't quite know how they're managing to pay these kind of salaries and not be punished, because there are meant to be points deductions. Did you get anywhere with all this?
Well, I actually, more than, I was just doing a piece on Saracens as a club, as a culture and all that before the Munster game, and I more looked into the investigations of some really good reporters in England who just ran out of steam, kind of the value of lawyering up, really. Okay. The Premier Rugby Limited just were unable to prove any wrongdoing. Yet the salary cap only goes up to 7 million next season, and I think they'd broken 9 million back in 2014.
Yeah.
It got as far as the legal wranglings, and they just, maybe it's the value of having a billionaire owned in your club. Like, in Nigel Ray sold half the club to Johan Rupert and others in 2008. And they did a remarkable thing in that pre-season. They brought in Brendan Venter as the great fixer who came in. And he brought Mark McCall with him quite quickly from Castra, because they played centre together for London Irish. And in that pre-season, in their first season in charge, after Eddie Jones, who's not a bad coach, had constructed a decent squad, they cut 18 players. Now, many of those 18 players were under 1 or 2 or 3 year contracts. They did buy them out. So they literally cleaned the decks.
Yeah.
That's a billionaire taking over a club and going, I'm going to create something special here.
Yeah.
I talked to Mark McCall before the Munster game. He was very gracious with his time. And he said, we trained at a St Albans, which is a small city in Hereford. None of the players are from there. So they've had to create their own cultural thing. Saracens, as you said, is famously a place, the Saint Andre's, the Pinards, these famous foreign guys coming in, North London, more or less. It is the construction of a club, but we see it in sport all the time. There's no reason why rugby weren't going to go down this road.
Yeah. Moving off Saracens then, and we'll see if they can complete the double-double. Warren Gatland has been talking in the last kind of 24 hours or so. He is expecting the usual kind of 6 to 10 players on being ruled out over the 10 games in New Zealand. So he was talking about his standby list, and he's got 12 to 15 names on his standby list, and presumably he's going to let these players know. One thing he said the best example of a player who was unlucky not to be picked in the original squad is Gary Ringrose. He did also say if the weather forecast says it'll be pelting down, then it could be someone else who comes in instead of him. But certainly if you're Gary Ringrose, you're presumably feeling optimistic. There's a standard thing, Eddie. I presume you all did it in 05?
Yeah, the only thing in 05, the irony of this is that I remember in 05, it goes to the squad now being 41 before they leave. You know, Clive Woodward named a squad of 44 in 05, and it was bedlam over the number of players, and there was players screaming and shouting about how the devaluing the Lions jersey and all this, you know. So it just shows that, you know, for all his flaws, Clive wasn't too far off the mark. He next to three players.
Although Gav was in here even a couple of weeks ago and made the point, the HIA protocols have certainly probably increased the necessity for numbers. That's a different aspect to 2017.
Well, you see, you can only deal with HIA as they happen. It's like the big problem with the Lions Tour is managing the logistics, and that was a problem with 05. But we ended up with about 50 players. I think it was another 4 or 5 players came out, you know. So it is hugely attritional, and I'm actually not against the notion of a large squad. The big challenge is basically how do you manage that large number of players and the staff, and it's kind of like a three-ring circus. It's the greatest show on earth, and it's kind of getting your arms around that. And 05 didn't get that done, and it was kind of catastrophic in the end. But yeah, I think he'll have a list that he'll have to go to. But I think he's been smart, and it keeps, you know, he was getting a bit of heat about someone like Ringrose. So he says, yeah, he was unlucky, and he might be out there yet. But then again, he might be. So like, it's kind of semantics. But to be fair, he's got to keep his powder dry, because if he says Ringrose is next man up, and then for whatever reason, when he gets there, finds he doesn't think he's the next man up, he's going to get flayed for not doing it if he has to. So it's a kind of in an enviable position to be in. But you'd like to think Ringrose, though, is on the shortlist, you know, and it's one of these, like Michael Driscoll back in Australia in his first Lions tour, like kind of was a bolter, really, and then set the world alight. You feel that's in Ringrose, you know. So we all want to think that that's the dream story, that he's landing his first Lions tour and light it up.
A little bit harsh as well, Eddie, that he was being called a fair weather, a top of the ground kind of a runner. I think he's proved this season that he can hack it in the meaty winter games, can't he?
Absolutely.
I think we don't even know if Joseph can, actually.
Yeah.
Well, the England game at the Aviva when it was wet would jump to mind.
Yeah, Ringrose hasn't put a foot wrong this year.
Going up against Davis on Friday now as well.
Yeah, but he hasn't put a foot wrong for Ireland. He's been incredibly stable in his game. The thing I liked about Ringrose all season, he didn't do anything wildly spectacular. He got a great try down in Claremont. But if you look at his game over the season, it's just his ability to deliver at a very high level consistently. That's what makes him the player he is. With a very limited experience under his belt, that's the great thing about him. Now, whether Warren Gatland sees that as somebody can parachute in for a potential test game in New Zealand, you'd like to think so. But it will be very attritional in New Zealand, and the weather won't be good. And if he's already saying that, you know, it's kind of maybe leaning against him. But look, we'd all love to see it because we think it's in him. But like, we're not picking the team, so that's just a drawback.
Eddie, you're really well placed because of 2005 and how that tour was so obviously split into two squads. Is it possible for them to maintain a one squad tour in 2017? For A, they got 41 players, and B, how can you possibly be in contention for a Saturday game if you play on a Tuesday, where all the main training's probably done on the Tuesday, Wednesday? So is it not inevitably just going to break into two tours again? Is that just the way modern rugby is?
Well, ironically, I would debate whether it was a two tour team. I think one of the problems we had in 05, it was about selection, is Clive insisted on rotating the squad week on week on week and midweek, and we never settled on a basic test team or test 15, which meant we had to forego building units like back row, front five, you know, a midfield. And he had this kind of wild card in his head about playing a first and second 5-8, which he felt would throw a curveball at New Zealand. So our midfield never played together. So we actually went into the first test with a test side that was relatively unknown. They had never really played together as a unit. Whereas I think they've learned from that, and you'll probably find what he has to do is about a week and a half into the tour, 2 weeks, he's got to start nailing down what he thinks his test side is, and then convince the other guys that there's probably two or three ways into this team. One is if somebody gets injured, or two, if you light it up on Wednesdays or Tuesdays, you could play your way in, or the guy in front of you has a couple of bad performances. And you kind of keep the pot lit like that by incentivizing it, for telling guys, if you light it up on Tuesday, you need to ramp up the pressure. But he has to nail his colours to the mast early rather than later. He's going to build a team in the sense of building units, like a midfield, a back row, a front five, a back five, that interface there, or a back three. He's got to try and get his feet under the table on that relatively early. Like, Clive did the opposite. He felt he could rotate players in and out. Like, I remember the Wednesday side in 05 won almost all their games, and they had a call, which I never liked, was called a midweek massive, you know, and the coach was Ian McGeachan, and he had the idea of the midweek massive, and the last week they gave out t-shirts to anyone who played on midweek massive, you know. It turned out like there was about two players didn't get a t-shirt.
Right.
So, like, well, we had done a
O'Callaghan on the show on Thursday, and he's a very proud member of the midweek massive, and actually loved that tour. And you know, O'Driscoll was making the point that he trained with Dennis Hickey once across the whole 7 weeks,
right.
and it seemed like there were huge swathes of players who never even encountered each other for good chunks of that tour,
because the teams kept changing, like Wednesday, Saturday, or Tuesday, Saturday kept rotating. And for me, it had a more destabilizing effect in terms of selecting your best 15 for the test series than it did in terms of, I think, in fairness to Clive, like, there was a logic to what he was doing. He was trying to keep it competitive. He was trying to keep his powder dry. He always felt he could put the best test side together literally a week out of the first test. But I think myself, that was a flawed strategy, because it didn't give you time to build your units and build your combinations. And then he had the curveball of playing, you know, a first and second 5-8. That's two fly halves in the middle of the field, which, you know, was kind of disastrous in terms of how we played the game, and defensively we were very exposed.
Yeah, Stephen Jones.
Stephen Jones got in big trouble. And look, that was the logic. Now, we can all play Monday morning quarterback and say, I was wrong. But yeah, to be fair, that was his logic. But I think myself, it's a dangerous way to go. You need to build your test side and give them a couple of weeks together before the first test to play. And it doesn't mean it can't change. But you're not talking about 12 changes. You're talking about two or three changes, maybe based on injuries or guys dropping form or guys lighting it up.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way you got to go with it.
And you also have to balance that with trying to imbue the thing with a sense of togetherness. And, you know, it seemed like two very separate teams almost in 05. Like in 09, some of the players talk about the attention to detail. So the weather was good. And that's a key factor as they go to New Zealand, where it's not going to be good. But the weather was good in 09. So they would have an outdoor gym on the touchline. So even though there might have been separate parts of training going on, half the team doing weights or doing things on the sideline, the other team on the pitch together, they were all ultimately together, and there was kind of slagging back and forth between. And, you know, trying to manage all that with that number of players in New Zealand, even in 2017, it's going to be really, really difficult.
It is a big challenge. But in fairness, McGeoghegan Lions tour experience, he went from, I suppose, if you're looking at Cliver on the ultra-modern tour, Ian McGeoghegan went back to the old-style tour. He generated the kind of ethos, the togetherness, them against us, you know, the dirt trackers and the Saturday guys working together. He went a completely different angle on it, and it definitely, he'd learned, he was in New Zealand as well, you know, and he learned from that in the sense that this kind of projection into a new way of doing it didn't really, you know, get his arms around it. And I think he benefited from being in New Zealand, that he learned from the mistakes that Clive made, and he was able to make it a whole better experience. And I remember talking to Draco, and he, after O-9, he said, yeah, that he thought the O-9 tour was a much more, I suppose, cohesive, and guys were together more. There was more energy, everyone pulling in the same direction, than in 05, which was more disparate. So, yeah, I think they learned from 05. And I think, you know, Warren Gatland will have learned as well that this is the way forward, is keeping the unit together, which is tricky because they're all competitive. They're all internationals. They're all used to playing for their country. That is always the big challenge on a Lions tour. But he does have to nail his cause to the mast earlier rather than later, in terms of what he thinks his test side is, but keep other guys in the hunt and hungry for getting a shot, you know. And
which is nearly impossible already, isn't it? There's going to be 15 pissed off guys every week, isn't
it? Totally. It's the trickiest part of it, but that's what good management is about, you know. It's keeping guys on side and keeping guys. And one of the reasons the tour in 01 fell apart was that there was too few staff on the tour, and you had the Wednesday side was completely almost cut adrift from the test side, and that's where all the bellyaching started, and guys going off script, and you had all the final couple of weeks of that tour were very fractious. And I think Clive then overreacted to that by doubling everything, doubling the players, doubling the staff. He wanted to make sure the Wednesday side didn't feel aggrieved, and he probably went too far the other way. So somewhere in the middle lies the sweet spot where you can keep enough players on the tour to have a shot at winning and keep everybody on the same page and happy.
And did you feel like you got your head as a coach? Were you allowed to work with both sets of teams, or were you very much the first team, or like were there players on that tour you barely spoke to?
The way he split it is that he had myself and Andy Robinson and Phil Larder on the Saturday team, and he had Ian McGeoghegan and Fordy and Garrett Jenkins on the Wednesday team. Right. And we didn't kind of have much to do with each other because we were kind of like shifts passing in the night.
Yeah.
But the players kept moving. So we got to coach everybody all the time because they kept coming through our kind of channel. But it wasn't like you could build really kind of strong relationships and units of guys. There were so many guys there. Mm. It was very unwieldy. But the problem is now is they're not far off those numbers now. With 41 leaving the first day, we would have 44.
Yeah.
At least we know who's in charge, though. That's a lot of head chefs there in 2005. And at least it's clear Gatland's third tour. But I don't know if any of it really matters, because if you watch Crusaders Hurricanes in the weekend, they actually, a Crusaders team without Kieran Reid, Dane Coles, Kano, we know they've loads of injuries at the moment. They did give a little blueprint about how to get the Bowden Barrett. This Crusaders and Hurricanes played a test match on Saturday morning there,
right,
without with I'd say maybe four or five guys who play for the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic stuff.
It's, yeah. And there was really bad weather as well.
Yeah, yeah. It was in rain. It was in sticky yeah. conditions. It was won by penalties. And it just showed how enormously difficult this Lions Test series will be.
Yeah, so they start off with the Provincial Union team on June 3rd. So it's very soon now. And then the Blues, Crusaders, Highlanders, Merry All Blacks and the Chiefs. That's all before the first test on the 24th of June against New Zealand. Like, there's a distinct possibility, Eddie, like, confidence mightn't be very high depending on how some of those games go. That's a serious fixture list to contend with.
Well, there's no doubt that, you know, psychologically, if you're getting a pounding, like, literally, on those games, particularly, you can lose a Wednesday game because maybe psychologically feel it's not the strongest team. But if your Saturday team is losing, and say losing, like, maybe 15, 20 points, like, getting a good raking, psychologically then to convince everybody that when we pitch up against the best 15 guys they have, we'll be able to pull it off. Psychologically, that's difficult because they start believing, look, if we can't beat their club side, so we're going to beat their test side. It's a subtle thing, and it doesn't mean it's not possible, but to convince guys, like, when you're getting a pound or if you're getting a pound and that it's going to be okay in a couple of weeks when you play a better team, that's a hard sell. So it is important. They mightn't win. I don't think they'll win every game in the build-up to the test, but they need to be competitive in every game. Mm. And then you start believing, look, it's a one-off. We can get these guys. It's going to be difficult. But if you're getting, you know, if you're getting a pounding by, you know, 15, 20 points, you're not anywhere near them on the Wednesday or Saturday, then it seeps into the psyche that it's going, like, how do we get it passed on the test side? That is the psychology of it. You know, it's a hard sell.
I ask a stupendously basic question, which occurred to me the other day, but I don't have the experience or your technical knowledge to give a good answer. Would you rather go out there with an Irish or English team who've been together and have a couple of years of work together and know each other inside out, or would you rather take your pick from the four nations and try and mould them together? Like, who actually has the better chance, an England or an Ireland or the Lions?
In some ways, an Ireland or England has a better chance. Like, we toured the year later, exactly a year later, and we had two tests in Hamilton and in Auckland, and we nearly beat them twice. I mean, we were a lot closer than the Lions were 12 months earlier.
You definitely should have won one of them, Eddie, shouldn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. No doubt about it. They'd got away from us like they had been for a long time. But having said that, certainly if you can manage the group, if your management skills are good, you can actually, let's be honest, the pick of the best players in the four home unions should give you a better team. But there is that cohesiveness and that energy and that synergy you need about everybody being on the same page. That is the tricky thing. It's like coaching the Lions team, there is technical and tactical, no question about it. But probably the biggest thing on a pin it is the management of these guys and keeping everybody's nose pointing in the same direction. Then you have a shot. But you definitely have a better chance with the best players from every country in terms of taking them on toe-to-toe. But it's a bigger task than rocking up with an Irish or a Welsh team where guys are all pointing in the same direction from the off.
I think the Pro 12 final and the English Premiership final are going to kill any chance of winning the Test Series. It just eats too much into the schedule. But just going back to your point at the very start, we learn a very valuable lesson about the backup players tomorrow, because if Jamie Heaslip and Rob Kearney get named in the Ireland squad to tour, or Sean Cronin for that matter, who were both all injured, and Leinster have been very, very vague about where they are along the line of recovery, if those three get on the tour, Japanese tour, they have a really good chance of getting called up. They're all one injury off. Well, certainly the two, Rob Kearney and Jamie Heaslip. So we're going to get a lot of information about primarily that tour, because the squad's out tomorrow.
Okay.
But the backup for the Lions.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Gavin Comiskey, the Irish Times. Thank you. Eddie O'Sullivan, thanks very much.
Cheers, guys.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air for heart-stopping moments from the Premier League, FA Cup, Formula One, and more. All on Air Sport.